as a federal on-scene coordinator. I'm very happy to be here tonight, and I would like to make some brief introductions. Starting from my right is Mr. Chipper Loge, representing Exxon, Mr. Don Carpenter with Exxon, Captain Tony Alejandro, Coast Guard, Mr. Steve Provant, Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, and also Mr. John Bauer from the same agency. My intentions this evening were to go and introduce people who represent the various committees in the outlying communities like Seward, Homer, Kodiak, Valdez, et cetera, and some of the federal agencies and some of the state agencies, but we have so many of those people in here tonight that I'm going to dispense with that lest I offend one or many, many people, because there are so many here. The format for tonight's meeting will be as follows. I will turn the floor over first to Exxon to give their presentation. They will then open the floor up to any questions based on what they had to say. Turn the floor over to the State of Alaska. Again, questions. Coast Guard, questions. And then afterwards, turn the meeting open to the general audience to ask whatever questions they desire. When we're finished with that, we will adjourn the meeting. Mr. Loge.
Okay, I'm Chipper Loge with Exxon. Before starting our program tonight, let me make clear to you all the safety exits you'll have to go through in the event of an emergency. Go through the door you came in on the back of the room. There is one emergency stairwell about two-thirds of the way down the hall, immediately to your right, and it is marked, and head down the stairs. The other emergency stairwell is to the right, and then another right immediately through the coffee bar and to your left. I don't think there will be any need for the emergency exit, but just to make sure everybody is informed. I'd like to welcome you all to our briefing room. It looks like we've got more people than we counted on, so we'll have to see about a change of venue or expanding the room. Starting out, I'd like to introduce Don Carpenter and let him speak about our operations.
Really most importance to us as we begin our safety program or our winter program is safety. As we look back on the project since we began work doing both the free oil and shoreline cleanup in late March and early April, statistically we've had a very good year from a safety standpoint. If we compare our injuries per million man hours to the kinds of experience that we see in heavy industry, we've done a better job. As we've look at the continuing nature of the project, each month that progress got better. It got better in all areas of the project. So we feel very pleased with the kind of people that worked on the project and the emphasis that they placed on safety and the help that we had from many different areas, the federal OSHA, the state OSHA, the State Department of Labor, as we worked the problem to ensure that we would have a minimum number of injuries on this project. We were very aware that you don't have a good safety program if you have fatalities involved, and recently there was a tug towing a barge that had worked on the project during the summer months, as it left to go back to its home port, sank, and there were fatalities involved in that. That tug went down in heavy weather. So that's certainly something that none of us like to have happen to us, especially those of us who work continually in projects where this kind of danger is involved. We are taking steps to ensure that we've protected the safety of everyone who will be working on the project during the winter months, and we've done it in two or three different ways from an equipment, a training, and a control standpoint. From an equipment standpoint, the boats that we're using will be large Coast Guard certificated vessels that we've reviewed and feel very comfortable working in the conditions that we'll have them working in. Most of our aircraft are twin-engine aircraft. We do have a couple of turbine beavers that we'll be using that aren't twin-engine aircraft, but shortly we'll be moving to a place where we'll fly all of our aircrafts in tandem, that is, two at once, so that we will have two different groups going to the same place at all time to watch that problem. We've increased our weather forecasting capabilities so that we have a continual update of what's going on throughout the area. We have some plans for adding some weather buoys so that we'll have updated information throughout the Sound and Gulf of Alaska during the winter. We have taken some steps to provide emergency equipment for people in case they did get caught out someplace and had to survive overnight someplace till we could go pick them up. On a training standpoint, each of the people after the 15th of October that fly on our aircraft will have had an 8-hour aircraft survival training course. That course is currently in progress, and we'll continue until we have everyone trained that we feel that we'll need to fly out into our operations. We have stopped all of our flights except essential flights that have a mission to go out for a specific purpose. Earlier, we had many flights, over flights, taking a look at the beaches, but we have limited our flights now for some specific purpose as designed in our winter plan, which I'm sure many of you have had the opportunity to see. We are also giving survival training or some training to those workers who will be on a call-out basis for us for the winter, and we're providing some materials and training materials for the villages, as you'll hear that we have signed up for the winter program. And then from a control standpoint, as I've mentioned, we are using only trained people to use our equipment in the winter, and so we feel real good. I guess one specific step that we're taking that's not really our idea, but Alyeska has a plan that anyone who leaves by land from Valdez in the winter, they have a check-in and check-out plan to have that person log in and log out of Valdez and log in when they reach their destination. So if they don't reach that in a prescribed amount of time, that someone is sent to see what happened to them along the way so that we don't get anybody trapped on the road. So we're implementing that plan also for our people in the winter. So we feel comfortable that we've taken the necessary steps to go above and beyond what would be needed to protect the safety and well-being of those people that are working throughout the winter. We'd like to give you some update on where we stand on our not only just our winter program, but the transition that we're making from what we've done throughout the summer into the winter program. So I'd like to turn it over to Chipper, who will talk to you about our organizations and people that we have.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the transition in several areas: organization, then equipment, and then waste management, and then we'll follow that with a discussion on our winter program. I'd like to say a few words about our organization. We still have a total of about 2,470 people actively involved in the project. 261 of those are Exxon. About half of the total number of people involved are currently still located in Valdez, about 30% here in Anchorage, with significant numbers of people still remaining in Seward, Kodiak, Homer. We still have an active claims and community liaison office in Cordova. Claims offices also in Kenai and Seattle. So we do have still a very active presence in Alaska. We will be decreasing the total numbers of people as the transition draws to a completion and our activities become more centered out of here in Anchorage. We do plan to continue having offices located in each one of the impacted cities, and so our presence will be there throughout the winter months. Now let me ask Ed Smith to talk about our equipment transition.
Good evening. I'm Ed Smith, the logistics coordinator with Exxon. I've been working out of Valdez all summer, and it's a pleasure to be here tonight to talk with you. When we began our transition, approximately 4 or 5 weeks ago. And moving the equipment out of the sound, we had a race with where we expected to be some pretty harsh weather conditions that we wanted to protect all of our people from. And we're very proud of the fact that although we've had some very narrow escapes in some of the harsh weather that we've run into, that we do now have all of the vessels off of the Prince William Sound and out of the Gulf of Alaska, with the exception of those boats that we selected for our winter programs. Now, of the 1,300 or so fishing vessels and the 350 major vessels, our Maxis and Omnis, our derrick barges and other pieces of equipment, our housing barges that were out in the sound, we have less than 100 left in Valdez to be washed, stripped, dismantled, and sent home. The equipment being sent home on ocean-going vessels under proper inspection of the U.S. Coast Guard. We're proud of that. It took a lot of work, and I want to say that it's been amazing to me because I saw a lot of cooperation there in the initiation of this project with the Coast Guard, the agencies, the local personnel who made up the workforces, the Alaskans that made up the workforces that helped mobilize this effort. It's amazing. It's maybe it's sometimes surprising the type of productivity that we're seeing and the cooperation that we're getting out of the different agencies and the transition that we're making into our winter program. Everyone, the MSO offices here in Western Alaska office, out of Kodiak and out of Valdez, has been very cooperative in providing the type of resources that have been necessary to make this move smoothly. And I want to thank you all for that. Another barometer that we check quite often of how well we're doing and the progress that we're making and moving into our transition is the amount of equipment that we had planned to relocate here into Anchorage. And there were some 1,700 to 1,750 loads of major equipment that we were to relocate here into Anchorage. We have moved approximately 90% of that equipment into Anchorage at this point in time. And again, we have seen just keen cooperation by the highway departments and all the different agencies that we've had to work with in making that movement. And again, we're very proud of it. We've, as I share with Don, we've had a disappointment with one of the vessels that worked with us throughout the summer. We worked very hard to protect each and every one of the vessels and the skippers and crews that have worked with us, and we're very much sorry that that happened. That's basically what I have to say. You have any questions?
Rob Dragnick will talk about our waste management program.
Good evening. As you can imagine, those of us in the sanitary end of the business are generally some of the last to leave, and we're still doing a lot of wrapping up in the Valdez area now. To date, we've disposed of just over 24,000 tons of oily solid waste. We probably only have another 8 or 10 days of activities to go in that area. We might generate another couple, 300-400 tons, so we're very close to the end on that part. Down in Seward, we have completed the demobilization and cleanup of the waste processing area that was down there on the McDonald property. We've also demobilized the chemical waste site. That site has been put in a standby mode for potential future use. We've also stored the contaminated sand and gravel from the waste processing area on the other site for either future use or disposal, depending on which is appropriate. We've completed the plan for decommissioning the Dayville Road storage area and began implementation of that last Saturday. We'd expect to complete that around the 15th of the month. That site also is being put in a standby mode for future potential use. The chemical waste management shredding facility in Anchorage continues to be operational with one shift. We would expect to complete activities there in about another 7 to 10 days when we finish all of the oily solid waste processing and disposal. Our major focus today really is on disposal of the liquids. To date, we've generated about 380,000 barrels and disposed of about 290,000 of that 380, or about 75% of the total. So you can see there's still about 90,000 barrels yet to be disposed of. That breaks down roughly in terms of about 50,000 barrels that we'd call the bilge waters, the oily skimmed waters, the waters that can be disposed of through Alyeska's ballast water treatment plant. So that's a little over half of it. That should be done here just within the next 3 or 4 days. about 23,000 barrels of the remaining wash waters, or the waters are wash waters, that is the waters that contain some detergent from equipment and boat washing activities, and of course that's the last type of water that will be disposed of because we're still generating small quantities of that. That's being disposed of at the Valdez Sewage Treatment Plant. We expect to complete that around the 10th of the month. And last, we have the recovered oil and moose, that is the oil from the skimming and field cleanup activities. Most of that oil will be, or all of that oil, will be going to the lower 48 for processing. The aerated treatment lagoon, or the sewage processing barge, has been completely decommissioned. We completed a clean-out on that barge today, and it'll be departing for Seattle just in the very near future. And I guess the last item, the Phoenix 121 barge that we had planned to depart here a few days ago, we've held over the departure of that to allow us to collect all the remaining oil, recovered oil on that barge. We want to make sure that we can get as much as possible on one major barge so we don't have that on a number of other barges. That should be leaving it also within the next few days. Any questions on waste disposal? Thank you.
Hey, turning now to our winter program, I'd like to introduce Ken Lewis to talk about the contingency response.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. On the winter program and the contingency response, if I could bring you up to date on our vessels. The Prince William Sound vessels, the Don Bollinger research and also response vessel. It's currently working in Herring Bay around Knight Island and it's involved in a crab study. The John Candies, which is the other Sound vessel, it's en route to Snug Harbour and it's doing a bird observation study. There are two vessels in the Gulf which are they're our transition vessels, the Yukon Queen, which is down in southeast Kodiak at present. It's conducting a sea current study. And the other one in the Gulf is the Arctic Rose, and that's over at Chignik at present, delivering village response material. The two permanent winter vessels for the Gulf. One of those is the Arctic Salver, which we've recently concluded the business arrangements. It's an outstanding vessel, 213 feet, 5,000 horsepower, and it's also a salvage vessel, which is a nice capability to have in the area. The closest one is Seattle. The other vessel is the Ensco Atlas. That's 195 feet, 6,000 horsepower vessel. And it's also an anchor handling vessel, which is a very nice capability to have. So the two vessels for the Gulf, big horsepower, great capability. With our aircraft, we have two in use down in the Kenai Peninsula at present by our SCAT team, and they're currently in shoreline monitoring. Both of those helicopters are fully winterized. There are two currently in Valdez. Both of those are winterized. And we have one in Anchorage currently being fitted out for winter operations. The Twin Otter is being fitted out for winter operations, and the one of the Beavers is now based in Anchorage. Touching on our personnel, we have already trained 270 people for call out for winter operations, and they're located in various areas. That number will increase. In addition, we have trained around 40 people who have been through a full 8-hour aircraft winter survival training program, and that program is continuing. In addition to the 270 which are available for call-out, during this period, however, we have a considerable amount of more people than that, something like 96 people in Seward, 38 in Homer, 120 in Kodiak, so by the time you add that together with Valdez, you're talking over 1,200 additional people. That, of course, will reduce. Talking about the equipment and the contingency response equipment, which has been located at various locations, and the four locations in which the large amount of equipment outside of Anchorage is located is at Valdez, Seward, Homer, and Kodiak. At each of these locations, there are five 40-feet connexes. For example, in Valdez, it's at the Crowley Weaver Dock. I see a lot of people here from Seward tonight, and you may have already seen the one that's installed at the railway dock there. At Homer, it's at City Dock, and in Kodiak, we have it installed at Lash Dock. Later this evening, or following me, Ed Gallatin will be bringing you up to date on the village program, but dealing only with the equipment, we have 14 packages ready, and these are the packages that are going to the villages, which they'll be using for monitoring and surface cleaning around their village areas. There are 14 packages ready. 9 have been installed already. One for Tatitlik will be delivered on the 5th of this month. The Chignik one, they're currently over there now, lifting that awful vessel with an S-61 helicopter. And Perryville will be installed this Thursday if the weather continues okay. On hatchery protection, which is a very important part of our business during the winter, we have had quite a few discussions with ADEC, and the equipment that we have proposed is laid out in our winter plan. We have just received a note from Steve Provon outlining what he would like. This is under review now, however, and we'll be getting back to Steve on this as quickly as we can. However, we have gone ahead and installed equipment there. It was important to have coverage there. At the Main Bay hatchery, for example, that package is completed and it's being installed today. The Eshami Bay, the package is completed there, it's installed. The Tutka hatchery, that's stored in Homer. And the Kitoi hatchery, that package is just put together and will be delivered very soon. And the other three hatcheries are non-state hatcheries, the Canary Creek hatchery. The package is complete and will be installed on Thursday. The Sawmill Bay hatchery, that's also there. However, the Norden boom that's there has been brought back in for cleaning, repair, and will go back out there in a container. There are several mooring systems left in place, and we're reviewing those at present to make sure there's complete coverage. The Esther Island hatchery, the package is complete and will go out there tomorrow. In addition, there's some pre-stage containment boom packages for the hatcheries, and these are Main Bay, Kitoi, and Eshami Bay. Those packages are either being assembled or complete and installed. Two are installed already. I'd like to bring you up to date on several minor spills that we've had, and also one sighting. On the 22nd of last month, there was a minor diesel spill in Valdez Harbour with the Shailene Nicholas. We dispatched 8 vessels with sorbents and 3 skimmers were sent over from Alyeska. On the 27th of the month, another diesel spill in Valdez Harbour with a vessel, the Betty L. Response skiffs and sorbent materials were dispatched with the Don Bollinger, which is the Prince William Sound response vessel. On the 29th of the 9th, we also had another minor diesel spill in Valdez Harbour with the Lady Simpson, and skiffs and sorbents handled that. We've made sure that we do have capability in Valdez. There's still quite a few vessels around there, and it's working quite well now. In addition, on the 26th of the month, we had a sighting around Sawmill Bay. It originated from ADEC, a sighting of sheen, some moose, possibly oil vegetation. It was too late in the afternoon at that time to safely fly and return in daylight hours. Early the following morning, an overflight was conducted with one of our senior managers from Sound Operations and also the Coast Guard. They could not locate any sheen at that time. I did distribute earlier in the evening a sheet which is an oil spill notification procedure. This is an update of one that was originally distributed around the 23rd of last month. Basically, because we've moved to Anchorage, there are some numbers changed. We will be updating this from time to time. The all of the non-Exxon sighted spills will be reported to the Coast Guard. Our own group within Exxon and our contract people will report them back to us and we'll contact the Coast Guard. We do have a fully dedicated telephone line in our control radio communication center, and I think the procedure is in place that our communications are solid. And that covers what I planned on dealing with you tonight. If there are any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them.
Ken, did you pull the Goodyear boom at main bay?
Yes, we have pulled it, and it's gone back in. I think it was pulled the day before yesterday, Steve, or yesterday possibly.
Yesterday was when.
Yeah.
Now, will that be reinstalled then until we can get? That was what we had talked to. I can't think of the gentleman's name.
Randy Buckley.
No, the...
Jim Tanner?
Jim Tanner, yeah.
Okay, yeah. The plan was for it to be put back in containers and go back out there. Since we've received your letter, we need to talk to you pretty rapidly about this and see if we can get a meeting of the minds on it. Okay? Good. Thank you very much.
Now I'd like to have Ed Gallatin discuss the village program with you.
Ed, before you go on, is Mr. Dave Kennedy out there by the door? No, he's not. There is two seats down front. If someone wants to sit down, there are two. Can't sell them tonight, huh? Oh, there goes a volunteer. We won't hurt you. There's two right there. There's one more. Don't be gentlemen. Just come on down. Go ahead, Ed.
I'll make a very brief report. We have 16 municipalities that we're dealing with relative to a shoreline monitoring program that we have for the winter. And we've been soliciting help from these particular municipalities. We have 14 signed up in our program. We expect to have another one before this week is over, and we're still waiting on another village's attorney to return our telephone calls, and we'll have maybe the 16th one signed up. We are, as Ken Lewis mentioned, we are in the process right now of putting out the equipment that goes with this program, and we have some additional equipment that we're in the process of preparing, which is a special sampling kit where we'll use a chain of custody process where we will be having villagers do some tarball collection for us along the way, maybe once every 2 weeks. Dependent upon weather conditions and safety. That's really all my report.
I have a question. I don't know, but for everyone's edification here, can you give the people an idea of what equipment you're providing?
Yeah,
not necessarily all of it, but the main ones, the big ones.
The main thing that we're providing, as Ken Lewis mentioned, we're putting a Connex out in each of these different areas, and we have... a lot of different booming material in there. We'll have some anchors. We'll have bags and gloves so that people can do passive cleanup on different beaches that might be of interest to them.
Exposure suits, radio equipment.
Yes, we'll have some Mustangs in there. We'll have some emergency equipment for people to use, such as some tents. You know, anybody goes out in a boat, we'll expect them to take some emergency equipment with them. We're providing all of that. We have some single sideband radios, some marine radios that'll be installed in the villages themselves, as well as handheld equipment to be carried on the boat.
Do you have boats also located in those communities that are going to tow that boom or wherever utilize that boom?
We do not have boats. We have a contractual relationship with the community. If they want to put out any booming material whatsoever, they use their own boats.
Could you tell us which communities have signed up?
Okay. We have Tetitlik, Seward, Homer, Seldovia, English Bay, Kodiak Island Borough, Nuzinki, Port Lyons, Larson Bay, Carlet, Aukiak, Old Harbor.
Did you provide any training to these communities about how to deploy that
boom? We have not provided that. There's no community that we're involved with that didn't have people already working on our programs throughout the summer.
some of which was some boom employment, deployment.
To wrap up our comments on the winter program, I'd like to introduce Bob Mastracchio to talk about our winter science program.
Evening. I'm really going to talk about one element of the science program, and that is the post-cleanup winter shoreline monitoring and surveillance. That activity was kicked off on September 17th and got off to a good start. The weather has cooperated so far. We'll be visiting sites over the winter to observe and record surface oiling, depth of oil penetration, and also to take samples of the sediments, measure hydrocarbons in the sediments, and also look for biological activity. The data will all be supplemented by photographs as well. We have a total of 18 stations in Prince William Sound and 10 in the Gulf of Alaska, spread across Homer, Seward, and Kodiak. So far, we were able to visit 22 of 28 sites in mid-September. And we hit 14 out of 18 in the Sound and 8 of 10 in the Gulf of Alaska. A couple of sites we're finding some difficulty getting into with the helicopters. During the course of the winter, we'll also be visiting 32 additional sites in both Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska, giving us pretty broad coverage of the oil-impacted areas. These additional sites will be conducting a less intensive monitoring program, but what we wanted to do was to get a sufficient cross-section of the data from different types of shoreline and the initial oiling to formulate an overall picture of the changes taking place over time. So we're hoping to visit all of these sites, which amount to, 60 sites, during September and October, and getting a benchmark for the changes that will take place over the winter. We'll continue to monitor later on in the winter, but I don't expect that we'll be able to maintain the coverage as the weather gets to be a lot more variable and difficult to work with. The program is being conducted by helicopter. That's our base means of transportation. And the teams are comprised of many of the same folks that were on the SCAT teams during the summer. And we also have U.S. Coast Guard personnel participating in these site surveys. So the teams are experienced and very familiar with the terrain and familiar with the initial oiling that took place. As mentioned earlier by Don, safety is paramount. All personnel are going to have to take an 8-hour survival training program. And that includes any managers who want to go out and see what's going on in the field as well, but there will be no exceptions. And this will apply to any people from the agencies or the Coast Guard riding in our helicopters or other aircraft during the winter. We're also redoing the oil shoreline mapping, again, to establish a post-cleanup reference. This is primarily based on video low-altitude overflights. But we'll also be doing some selected ground truthing to try and correlate what we're seeing from the air with what we're actually seeing on the ground, because calibration from the air is very difficult at this point. Any questions?
Are you going to be monitoring the erosion deposition longshore movement of the substrates, or is it just an aerial look?
No, we'll be on the ground.
Are you going to be monitoring the substrate stars, whether or not they're eroding or depositing or have long-term movement?
No, the monitoring won't be that sophisticated. You're talking about the movement due to storms?
Yeah,
we'll be doing that visually, but there won't be any, science.
We'll be transect surveys.
There'll be transect surveys, but it's not going to be as sophisticated as you might, your question might infer.
Okay. Have you got a list of those 60 sites?
Yes, we do.
So we could have possibly?
Yeah, I think we can provide you with that.
When you say that the agency upland managers will be allowed to come along, I was unaware of this in September. Is this information being made available to the upland managers for October?
To the agencies?
Yeah.
We hope so. We're trying to work out an agreement with ADEC and with NOAA to have a common understanding of data that we would share, because NOAA and ADEC have similar programs. And it would be to our mutual benefit to have as much knowledge about what's going on in the field as possible. But we'll hopefully be able to wrap that up shortly. Steve, you want to say anything about that?
It's under review right now, and I'll have comments on that tomorrow, and should be able to get you a copy of our final draft.
Okay.
Where can we get a schedule of your trips?
From
your survey trips.
From Tom Kelly.
Where is he?
He's located here in Anchorage. The ground rules for, you know, people other than the survey teams riding on the helicopters are space available bases. These are 212 helicopters. They have a lot of capacity, but they're carrying extra fuel tanks. We're taking a lot of samples, and the carrying capacity is much reduced.
You'll be flying out in tandem, 2-2?
No, there'll be single helicopters going out because they are twin engine. Helicopters will be going out individually.
Plus, they will have to complete a survival course.
Yeah.
That's mandatory.
Like, for instance, a survival course, is a class that's available to upland managers locally, or how is that going to be handled?
Well, we're conducting training courses. We've asked, ADA, for instance, to see if their training program would meet the requirements that we've set for ourselves. So there may be training courses available through other agencies that would meet our requirements, and we'll see how that works out.
But you're going to be through with this by the end of this month, this initial survey work.
Yeah, the initial survey work will be through the end of this month.
Okay.
Will your information on the 60 sites, will that be available for everybody, or?
It all depends. All depends if we have a mutual sharing of data between, you know, Exxon and the agencies. We are not going to turn over data if we don't have reciprocity. Our objective is to be able to share the data. That's our base case. Hopefully that'll work out.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions from Exxon, we'll turn it back to the Admiral.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Provan, State of Alaska.
All right. Talking one. We had a beautiful day in Valdez today, so it is good to get up to Anchorage every once in a while. We have 80 people in Valdez now, and 14 in Kodiak, 10 in Homer, and 10 in Seward, for a total of on staff right now of 114. We have four vessels working in the Sound right now, and we had two additional vessels that were just taken off contract here a few days ago. With that, I would like to introduce John Bauer to give us an update on our aerial surveillance oil report.
I'd like to give you a background on our program, then I have some maps behind me that I'll go ahead and identify some of the areas where we picked up some oiling over the last couple weeks. ADEC performs aerial reconnaissance in Prince William Sound, Homer, Seward, and the Kodiak areas, and what we're trying to do is to track and map any sheens out on the open water. We've done this since the early days of the spill, and we're going to continue this through the winter if the weather cooperates with us. We have a section in Prince William Sound that's dedicated just to doing aerial recons, and the personnel in the Seward, Homer, and Kodiak areas split their duties between the aerial recon and the shoreline treatment and assessment and the science programs. We generally have teams of two that fly between 300 and 500 feet above the water, and they map the areas of any oil sheen out there. We were limited by fog and some poor flying conditions over the past couple weeks, and we flew roughly half the time. The maps I have behind me are composites of the work we've done from September 15th through September 30th. The red colored areas identify ADEC siting of oil sheens. These areas do not necessarily mean that all these locations were oiled all the time, but that at some time during this period that we detected oil out on the open water. There may be areas where there were other sheens that aren't indicated just because we didn't have our flights over that area. We couldn't cover all the areas, and we try and prioritize our flights just to get to the main area.
Let's just leave the front.
I'll go to the second. Generally, the oil sheens we found were grayish silver in color, and they were adjacent to areas of the heavy oil shoreline. See, this is Prince William Sound, and the areas where we detected sheen were in the Eleanor and Ingot Island areas. We had a large sheen that was in the upper Knight Island area. We've got heavily oiled areas in Herring Bay. This is Point Helen here, and we had a lot of sheens that came off it. This is Sleepy Bay down at Latouche Island. Cannon mentioned that we had some sheens out in Sawmill Bay, and that's identified down here. Here's the hatchery, and here's the village of Chiniga. We had some sheens up here just north of Ashami, and we did pick a sheen up within the Ashami Lagoon and also up in Main Bay. The other sheens that we detected were up here in Perry Island, which came off some of the points down in here and also on the northeastern side of the island. Smith Island was heavily oiled. As most of you know, and we got a lot of sheens on the north side of that. The south side of the island received very little oil, and conversely, we had no sheens there. We do have some sheens bleeding off Green Island, and we also picked up some sheens in areas we didn't identify before down on Latouche Island. That's on the northwestern side of the island here. Yeah, areas for the other sectors.
By sheen, do you mean a thin film? Do you mean mousse? Do you mean thick? Just
most of the
common definition.
Yeah, most of the sheens were silver to gray in color, and those are light sheens. We did get some copper and some rainbow-colored sheens, which are thicker than the gray sheens.
And are all the sheens related to the Exxon Valdez? Because you had a bilge pumping out there with that large one, or what? Have you correlated them to the Exxon Valdez case?
I don't know what this was, because we'd have to sample it to see what it is, and I don't know. You know, I will say that all these areas were heavily oiled, and I'd be pretty certain that it came from the Exxon Valdez. The sheen up here, I don't know. We had the storm that went through, and whether it moved off the beaches and went up there, I'm not certain. Most of the oil that's on the surface is weathered, and we're getting, we don't really get any sheens off it. It's the oil that's down in the sediments that is still fluid that is freed up when we have a storm. The beaches turn over, and the oil is released out into the environment.
Good. Thank you. It's important to say that.
All right. Cover the other areas here. If I don't tip this over. This is in the Seward area. They had sheens that they detected at Pony Cove out in the Chiswell Islands. There was some mousse that they picked up out there. Quite a few sheens over at MacArthur Pass and Morning Cove in the Pie Islands, and also at Hook Point and Wildcat Cove, and that's the area in here. This is Pie Islands. Also picked up sheens over in Tonsina Bay and one off Gore Point down here. If you can see this or not, this is in the Homer area, and we had one small sheen. I forgot this point up here. This is in Port Dick. I want to say Petroff Point. Is that right? No one knows. Pike Point. Also had some sheens out in Windy Bay, and also out in Chugach Bay. And Grungy Cove also has some sheens coming off it. We have these sheens out there that we don't know about. And finally, the Kodiak area, it's had very little sheening throughout the year. And we had teams that were out that covered most of Kodiak Island and also over on the Alaska Peninsula. And the only sheens that they detected were at Molina Bay and also between Ban Island and Cape Horanoff. And that's pretty well it. Do you have any questions?
I do, John. How many of these are, you know, you've been amassing this data over a 15-day period. Have all these been reported in the normal setup that we have put in place for following up on reported sheens anywhere? Or are you all holding on to this data?
We put this data in our daily report.
We've set up a reporting system whereby any sheens that are sighted are supposed to be reported to the Coast Guard so that we can go out, investigate, try to ascertain the source, you know, whether it's from a vessel pumping, Exxon Valdez related, et cetera. Has that been done?
I don't know. I can't answer your question. Also, sorry. I'll check on it.
No, I don't think so, and I don't think that was our intent to, on every overflight, to report every sighting of oil we see. I mean, we'd be calling you guys continuously.
Well, but you're amassing a lot of data
that
we're not going to be able to correlate, and the inference is going to be that it's all related to this slick, and that goes contrary to the procedures that we have had in place well before, you know, this bill occurred. We need to share this information and get it.
We've been doing this all summer long, reporting oil out here, or, you know, doing aerial surveillance, and we haven't reported. And I thought it was pretty much a. Just like we did with Tom L. Bay.
Okay, so basically you're saying then that these sightings, even if we had followed up on them, we would not have been able to clean them up?
Well, I don't think that we, I don't think that we're really looking at doing open water containment and cleanup here.
No,
I
agree with you.
Yeah, so, you know, we're looking at, we'll report to the Coast Guard those things that we think need to be dealt with.
Why don't we tomorrow morning go ahead and just re-examine the procedures we have in place, and then we'll get back on a good footing again.
Okay.
Just so we understand where we're each coming from, and I think that's it. I think maybe we have a communication problem here, and we'll work it out between us as we have in the past.
Okay.
Have you been able to get below Wide Bay between the area on the Alaska Peninsula between Wide Bay and Chicken?
I don't know where Wide Bay is.
It's south and off of your map.
Yeah.
I don't know. My guess is probably not, just because of the distance that's out there, and our teams are trying to do a post-assessment survey of the oil shoreline that we have out there that Steve's going to talk about. And so most of the reconnaissance that we've done out here has been in conjunction with our post-treatment assessment. And my guess is that if it's down here, that they probably not get out to that area and even survey it. We did have some teams that were down in the Trinity Islands, but I don't think we had any teams over in there, although I can't say for certain. I apologize for not knowing.
What's the cooperation with the Fish and Game's Navigable Stream Program? And that was 2 weeks ago. And they were, John Hopkins was there for 10 days.
Do you know if they noticed any sheens out there?
They didn't report any sheens, no, except in Chicken Bay, and they figured that came from pumping builders.
Okay.
Yeah, there was some reports of sheen off the Chicken that I read someplace. I've read so many things, I don't remember whether it was in the newspaper or whether it came out in a report from DEC. That's why I asked the question.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Okay. With regard to our post-summer 89 activity beach survey, we've been conducting that now for the last 23 days, with field work conducted on 18 and a half of those days. Bad weather did prevent us from conducting activities on 1.5 days, and we lost another 3 days due to just a combination of poor tides or low tides with poor light, and so we weren't able to work safely on those days. 92.5% of the projected field time has gone according to plan, with only 7.5% of the field time lost due to bad weather. In the Seward post-treatment surveys, they focused on heavy and moderate shoreline areas, and approximately 50% have been surveyed as of September 30th. In the Homer area, approximately 90% of the heavily to moderately impacted treated shorelines have been surveyed as of October 2nd, and approximately 25% of the beach segments with light, very light, and no oil have been surveyed. In the Kodiak area, we started post-treatment surveys on September 19th, focusing on heavily and moderately impacted shorelines which received treatment by Exxon. As of October 2nd, 90% of the post-treatment surveys had been completed on the Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak, Afognak, and Chugiak Islands. And we've got a chart here to show graphically. We've just colored in the islands, but these are the islands that have been assessed so far. They're currently working on Green Island. We've assessed all of Night Island. And done Lone, working on Perry on Kuros. Yeah. And the mainland here around Main Bay and Ishami Bay. And we still have to do Chiniga. And we don't have Latouche on here, but we've got Latouche about 75% completed. That information will be put together in a mapping report, as we did earlier in the spill, and we'll come out with an updated map of lightly, moderately, and heavily oiled shoreline segments. Does anybody have any questions on this activity? Yes, sir.
How is that being done?
Sure. They're out walking the beaches. The crews are calling up the walk-a-thon. We've got, 20 people out there now, I think, doing that activity with three boats, actually a crew's living on three boats, and one boat is acting as a supply boat.
They're also mapping the subsurface oil that's out there. We're trying to prioritize these areas so we can develop some treatment plans this winter, and hopefully the technology review section can go ahead and use that information to try and develop some techniques to get the oil out of the subsurface, and also help the aero recon section with knowing these areas are still heavily oiled with subsurface oil, and they can prioritize their flights over those areas.
Do you know when those will be available, Steve, and how they
might get copied? Yeah, I hope that we have them available at least by the end of October, and we'll make sure the copies are available either through bring them here to this meeting, or we can just probably most of the agencies will send out copies to them. So. Are there some other questions? Okay. I'd like to introduce Lance Trasky, who will give us an update on the winter hatchery protection from the state. Yes, please.
Yeah, the Department of Fish and Game staff have worked with ADEC to develop winter protection plans for three state hatcheries and two other important habitat areas in Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska. Now, these include the Main Bay, Tutka Lagoon and Katoy hatcheries, and tidelands near Chenega, the village of Chenega, and Ishami Lagoon. And the plan consists of a minimum equipment inventory with a what we felt was a four-hour maximum response time to deal with any oil that's threatening these sites during this winter. And the plan that we've developed supplements the original Exxon proposal with additional safety, transportation, containment, communications equipment, and some training for the use of this stuff. We felt this was necessary to provide an adequate level of protection for these facilities and sites. The state plan and the additional requirements are detailed in a September 30th letter from Steve Provant to Mr. Rabinow of Exxon, And at this time, we're still waiting for a response on our proposal.
We mentioned earlier, I believe Ken Lewis said that we would respond. We received the letter today. We are actively looking at it, and we certainly will respond. I think our people, though, have been in direct communication with ADEC throughout, and we have had some earlier proposals which did not seem reasonable. Now, we'll look at your new proposals and certainly respond to those as quick as we can analyze them.
Okay, good. Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks.
Thank you, Lance.
The last item on our agenda is the substrate transplant experiment, which sounds like it ought to be conducted in a hospital, I guess. But this experiment was established in Prince William Sound to determine the threshold level of oiling on rocky substrates above which colonization by algae and invertebrates are adversely affected or inhibited. The experimental design also addresses the impact of re-oiling of treated beaches on recolonization. And what our crews have done here is to take rocks from oiled areas and transplant them into non-oiled areas, and then they'll measure the rate of growth of recolonization on those. And they've had very various variations on this. Yeah. But they took 80 rocks and cemented them in the intertidal zone of Gull Island in the northeastern sector of Prince William Sound. And this set of rocks included tarred and oil-stained rocks from water-treated and Corexit-treated beaches. One of the these controls was a set of rocks taken from the same beaches that had been thoroughly cleaned with a solvent to remove all oil from them. They then took 20 rocks and cemented them in the intertidal zone of Eleanor Island, and they took 20 rocks and cemented them in the intertidal zone of Smith Island. Randomly selected rocks were then also removed from each set and returned to the lab as handling controls and time zero reference sets. The experiment will be monitored throughout the fall, winter, and spring for recolonization of algae and invertebrates on the rocks. So we're interested to see what this will show us in the rate at which organisms might be likely to get started recolonizing some of the areas that have been impacted. Are there any questions?
Good question.
Yes.
Does it include some clean rocks too that were never oiled?
Yes.
Control?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And the Department of Fish and Game is your oversight agency for that, or is it DEC or a private?
It's contract? DEC is doing it.
I have a question going back a little bit earlier. You said you had four vessels in Prince William Sound. Can you tell me what vessels they are, how many, what footage they are?
I'll tell you the names. I can't tell you the footage. And go ahead, John.
The Nautilus is an 80-foot vessel, and it's we've got about 15 people berthed on it. The Gaviano 2 is a 49-foot vessel. The Denali is, I believe, a 45-foot vessel, and the Resolution is a 53-foot vessel.
These vessels we'll have them on contract through the 15th of October, the 21st of October, and then we're going with a larger vessel in the 90-foot class that we'll maintain them throughout the winter. We'll also have a vessel out of Homer, a large vessel that will be working in the Homer Kodiak area, and also a vessel out of Seward.
Thank you.